Welcome to Onc Live On Air. I'm your host today, Ashling Wehner. Onc Live On Air is a podcast from Onc Live, which provides oncology professionals with the resources and information they need to provide the best patient care. In both digital and print formats, Onc Live covers every angle of oncology practice, from new technology to treatment advances to important regulatory decisions. In today's episode, we had the pleasure of speaking with Jordan B. Milner, MD, Mansi Dalal, MD, and John Ligon, MD, about findings from three abstracts presented at the 2023 Transplantation and Cellular Therapy Meetings. Dr. Milner is a clinical assistant professor in the Department of Pediatric Hematology Oncology at the University of Florida College of Medicine in Gainesville, Florida, where Dr. Dalal is a clinical assistant professor in the Department of Pediatrics and Dr. Ligon is an assistant professor in the Department of Pediatrics. In our exclusive interview, Dr. Milner shared findings from a study, co-authored by Drs. Dalal and Ligon, on hematopoietic stem cell transplant in children with severe aplastic anemia. Additionally, Dr. Dalal explained the results of a study on graft failure risk factors in children receiving hematopoietic cell transplant for non-malignant disorders. Finally, Dr. Ligon discussed findings from a study investigating the use of metaports for CAR T-cell infusion. So speaking first about the presentation, outcomes of children with severe aplastic anemia who received hematopoietic stem cell transplant upfront or after immunosuppressive therapy, Dr. Milner, could you provide the rationale for this research?
Yeah, absolutely. So just to give a little bit of background, Dr. Biliana Horn had an initiative to have the Florida Pediatric Bone Marrow Transplant and Cell Therapy Programs get together and form a pediatric bone marrow transplant consortium. And through that cohort, we've been able to really extrapolate larger sets of data utilizing the CIBMTR enhanced data back to center platform. And so with this, we really wanted to see what the outcomes of patients who underwent transplantation for severe aplastic anemia, how those outcomes were compared to those that had it after immune suppressive therapy.
Can you expand on the patient population that was studied here?
So again, all of these patients were transplanted in Florida transplant centers. We had 52 pediatric patients, and this was from the years of 2010 to 2020. So we were able to really show the different donor types that were utilized, unrelated versus related, matched versus haploidentical in these patient subsets.
What efficacy findings from this study were presented at the tandem meetings?
Through this, the outcomes were actually much improved in those patients that did not receive immunotherapy and those that really underwent transplantation within 12 months of time, despite donor type. And so what that really goes to show is that it is safe and feasible for pediatric patients to get haploidentical transplants using post-transplant cyclophosphamide techniques.
What are the next steps for or future implications of this research?
We are part of the National American Pediatric Aplastic Anemia Consortium, and we're participating in the transit study using the matched unrelated donor versus immune suppressive therapy in a prospective trial, but we're also considering other techniques. And if we don't have a matched unrelated donor or matched sibling, should we just move forward with a haploidentical transplant instead of providing immune suppressive therapy this time?
Talking now about risk factors for graft failure in children undergoing hematopoietic cell transplant for hemoglobinopathies, bone marrow failure syndromes, severe aplastic anemia, inborn errors of metabolism, and primary immune deficiencies, Dr. Dalal, can you describe the rationale for this research?
The diseases that are being mentioned here, the hemoglobinopathies, bone marrow failure syndromes, etc., those are our non-malignant disorders, and majority of them have allogeneic transplantation as the only potential curative therapy. And in the past 10 years, I would say the indication for allogeneic transplant for these diseases have increased. And so more patients are undergoing transplantation. And especially because our transplantation supportive care have improved, and also we're now using more haploidentical donors, we have seen that more patients are being transplanted for non-malignant disorders. But what we're also noticing is that a lot of these patients continue to have graft failure. And it is much higher in non-malignant disorders than those patients who have acute leukemia who undergo allogeneic transplantation. And so we wanted to look at what are the potential risk factors that could be contributing to graft failures in this group of patients and whether we can potentially identify these patients ahead of time. So that was sort of the rationale for why we wanted to look at this specific question.
What patient population was observed here and what common risk factors did they have?
Similar to the severe aplastic anemia abstract, this specific study looked at patients who had undergone transplantation for non-malignant disorders in the Florida consortium. We also looked at data going back from 2010 to 2020, and we were able to identify 226 patients who had undergone transplantation for non-malignant disorders. The patient's age group was between 1 and 20 years of age, and we were able to find that out of the 226 patients, 22 patients ended up receiving second or third transplantation. That's about a graft failure rate of 9.7%. These patients also, interestingly, the ones that received second transplantation had much lower two-year survivor compared to the ones that did not require a second transplantation. So the risk factors that we identified are specifically HLA mismatch with the donor and the recipient, and also CMV serology mismatch, and then also if they had received reduced intensity conditioning. Those were the three main risk factors that we have identified through this study.
What other findings presented at the meeting would you like to highlight?
One of the things that we did was we looked at these risk factors individually, and then we also combined them together to see if these risk factors predicted a increased risk of graft failure. And we found that patients who've had HLA mismatch donor combined with reduced intensity had the highest prediction for graft failure. And this had a sensitivity of almost 100%. Although it didn't have high specificity, we feel that these two risk factors are probably the most important risk factors for predicting graft failure in this group of patients.
What preemptive strategies may reduce graft failure in this population?
So based on this study, I think it's really important to consider when we're doing transplantation for non-malignant disorders to look at the donor type and making sure that we can find the best donor match and try to reduce donors who have HLA mismatch. The other one is CMV serology, if we can avoid it, and then trying to use myeloablative conditioning when possible, especially if the patients do not have any pre-existing comorbidities or organ dysfunction that precludes them from receiving myeloablative conditioning. The other thing is monitoring if, you know, these patients have these risk factors and continue to receive the allogeneic transplantation is to monitor them closely, specifically looking for signs of rejection and then also specifically looking for viral infections because viral infections are a known cause for graft failure. So, and especially if you have a patient who've had CMV serology mismatch, then monitoring the CMV earlier on, providing them with prophylactic CMV therapy and making sure that if they have CMV reactivation, we treat it aggressively to avoid potentially risk of developing graft failure.
What are some next steps for or future implications of this research?
So this was a retrospective study, and so I think it would be great to able to look at this specifically in a prospective manner. And so for future developing a future study where we're looking at these risk factors prospectively, and then also combining them with some biomarkers that other groups have published that predict graft failure, including CXCL9, I think doing this in a prospective manner would really help us identify patients who are at increased risk of graft failure. And then once we do that, we can potentially use medications to decrease inflammation, especially if these biomarkers are elevated and we have targetable agents that we can use for these biomarkers. So that would be kind of the future studies that we can potentially look at for in this group of patients.
Now moving on to Metaport use as an acceptable standard for CAR T-cell infusion, Dr. Ligon, can you share the importance of establishing practice standards for CAR T-cell delivery and how this research aimed to refine those standards?
This is a question that was raised in regards to CAR T-cells, which I think everyone is familiar with now, but just to review, it's a new way of engineering a patient's white blood cells to be able to recognize cancer and to engineer them to kill the cancer cells. And it's really a new treatment modality that has entered the clinic in the last 10 years and gone all the way from early phase clinical trials to where we now have one commercially available pediatric CAR T cell. And there are five FDA approved CAR T cells for adult indications as well. Historically, because CAR T cells are administered by bone marrow transplant physicians, we have a general practice to avoid using metaports for giving our transplant products to ensure that you get directed systemic delivery, make sure that you don't have issues with metaport dislodgement or cell infiltration into the surrounding soft tissues. In general, I think there has been historically some reticence from the community to using metaports for stem cell administration, and that has kind of carried over into CAR T cells. For our patients with leukemia, where many of them have metaports already in place, it would be very beneficial if we could use the metaports for the administration of CAR T cell products. That way, we can avoid doing an extra procedure to change the lines or giving them multiple lines, which could put them at risk for complications such as infection. This was a study that was conducted by the Pediatric Real World CAR Consortium, which UF recently joined as a member this year, to look at current practice patterns across the United States in this consortium of 35 different centers to see what we're all doing in regards to metaports.
What patient population was specifically observed here?
So this was a retrospective study based on current practice patterns at the different Pediatric Real World CAR Consortium sites. We didn't collect patient-specific data, but these are all pediatric patients, or at least patients who received their CAR T-cell products at a pediatric center since the FDA approval for the pediatric CAR in 2017 through August 2022 when they started collecting data for this study. So this was all kind of based on a practitioner report of the current practices at their center.
What findings from this study were presented at the meeting?
Out of the 35 centers in the consortium, 34 of the centers were able to respond. All of them reported that using tunneled central lines like Broviax and Hickman lines were accepted as standard lines. But interestingly, 85% of the centers, or 29 out of 34, also reported that they were able to administer CAR T cells through metaports, and none of them reported that they had had any complications such as infiltration into soft tissues around the line or any other issues regarding using metaports. Interestingly, out of the 34 centers, six centers even reported that they were able to use peripheral IVs for the administration of CAR T cells. So really challenging the historical practice that cellular therapy products should be administered exclusively through central venous lines, and showing that metaports are currently accepted and safe at these centers for administering CAR T cells.
Can you elaborate on the implications of these findings on clinical practice?
This is hugely important for our patients because it can potentially remove the need to do these extra procedures to get additional lines for giving CAR T cell products. But I think I would just also highlight that the fact that we were able to do this study at all and connect these 35 centers and pool all of our experience and finding that it was feasible to conduct this study was really important, because I think that the clinical trials where we report the findings that led to the FDA approval of these CAR T cells, they're really important publications, but they're also kind of a very controlled clinical trial setting. And we all know that when you get out into the real world, the outcomes can really be different. So gathering this real world data of how centers are administering CAR T cells and the outcomes that are being reported in the real world is going to be hugely important. I know that there are a number of prospective studies that are currently being designed and implemented by the Pediatric Real World CAR Consortium that we are intending to participate in and I think that this is going to be very important for us to establish the standard of care with these novel treatments in the real world setting.
That's all we have for today. Thank you for listening to this episode of OncLive On Air. Check back on Mondays and Thursdays for exclusive interviews with leading experts in the oncology field. For more updates in oncology, be sure to visit www.onclive.com and sign up for our e-newsletters. To read additional coverage from the meeting, visit www.onclive.com/conference/TCT. OncLive is also on social media. On Twitter, follow us at OncLive and at OncLiveSOSS. On Facebook, like us at OncLive and OncLive State of the Science Summit, and follow our OncLive page on LinkedIn. If you like today's episode of OncLive On Air, please consider subscribing to our podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, Amazon Music, and many of your other favorite podcast platforms so you get a notification every time a new episode is posted. While you are there, please take a moment to rate us. Thanks again for listening to OncLive On Air.